Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. December 10th, Tuesday, 2013. 9/11? Who's really responsible?
But the world watched in horror. Two hijacked planes destroyed our trade center. We better believe it. We better deal with it. It's time to keep peace a chance.
I think Yoko Ono had good intentions when she remixed Give Peace a Chance with that intro back in 2004. But I always cringed when she said, "You better believe it." Because I don't believe the official story of 9/11. I personally witnessed the whitewash as it was underway by the 9/11 Commission. And the number of questions that remain today, more than 12 years after those grisly events, deserve honest answers. And Bob Graham, the former Democratic senator from Florida who was on the Intelligence Committee, has been trying his darndest, his damnedest, to draw attention to the Saudi nationals who were living in Florida with deep ties to the royal family and the ruling class of Saudi Arabia. And they are the subject, in part, of a 28-page document that has been identified and redacted, it's been declared classified, since the Bush administration. And I want to credit Walter Jones. He is an evangelical Republican. He was one of the first to come out against the war in Iraq and to demand U.S. withdrawal. And he's one of the few principled Republicans who I can identify in Washington today. And he's joined forces with Democrat Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts. And they recently gained access to the unredacted version of this 28-page document, and they are shocked. Jones told the International Business Times, "I was absolutely shocked by what I read. What was so surprising was that those whom we thought we could trust really disappointed me. I can't go into it any more than that. I had to sign an oath that what I read had to remain confidential." And his colleague Lynch of Massachusetts echoed that sense of shock. Now, journalists have been able to piece together some of what is in this document. The 28 pages portray that the Saudi government had at the very least an indirect role in supporting the terrorists responsible for the 9/11 attack. In addition, these classified pages clarify somewhat the links between the hijackers and at least one Saudi government worker living in San Diego. Bob Graham has been trying for years to draw attention to this document and what it suggests to us. That it wasn't just a guy in a cave with a bunch of jihadis who pulled this off. And we know the long-standing relationship between the Saudi government, its jihad desk, and the funding of individuals and groups in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And Lynch is quoted as saying, "Once a member reads the 28 pages, I think whether they're Democrat or Republican, they'll reach the same conclusion that Jones and I did, which is that Americans have the right to know this information." In addition to the San Diego connection, the $73,000 that was shipped by check from Prince Bandar and his wife to a guy named Bosnan, who was paying the rent for the Saudis who were taking flying lessons in San Diego. I mean, it is stunning. And then there is this house at the gated community in Florida, near Sarasota, where the Al-Hijji family was living. They're the ones with the connections to Prince Abdulaziz Al-Saud, the nephew of the king of Saudi Arabia. They moved out of their home in a hurry, just weeks before 9/11, I left behind three luxury cars, food in the fridge, the swimming pool water was circulating. They got the hell out of there. And records at the gated community's visitor logs and photos of license tags show that vehicles driven by several of the 9/11 hijackers had visited the Al-Hijri home. Now, this is circumstantial evidence, but the government has gone to great lengths to suppress it. And I have friends who ridicule me for being a tinfoil hat, conspiracy theory embracing truther. But come on, just like the Kennedy assassination, 9/11 was a conspiracy. It was a group of people who committed a crime. We're just trying to get to the right conspiracy theory. And we've been fed a pack of lies, and anybody who is intellectually honest, who examines the information about Building 7, about the freefall implosion of Towers 1 and 2, about the absurd story of Flight 93, and about the physical impossibility of an airliner fitting into the hole in the Pentagon, which simply was not large enough to swallow it. The evidence is overwhelming, but the media and our elected officials have been able to create a force field around the official story. Anybody who attacks it is a lunatic. Anybody who has rational thoughts and questions the very weak evidence that's been presented to date is ridiculed. Someday I hope we really do break the story and get at the truth. And I, for one, am not going to give up. Nope, not ever. Some good news for journalists. Lawyers for a Fox News reporter named Jana Winter, who has been chased by Colorado lawyers for James Holmes, the man who is accused of shooting up the Aurora, Colorado movie theater that was showing Batman a year ago in July. Well, fortunately, there is a shield law in the state of New York. And a court has ruled that it protects Jana Winter from having to disclose her sources, the sources who told her that there had been psychiatric information shared, a file, about the suspect with officials of the college that he was attending there in Colorado. And I think this is very significant. And it shows that we need a federal reporter shield law. We don't have anything like it at the federal level, and in particular when it comes to national security whistleblowing and just good journalism about national security. And while, you know, you and I may not be delighted that Fox is the victor here, well, we all win when standards and protections for journalists are properly upheld under our Constitution. I'm grateful to the people who support my program by subscribing, and we've got a hotbed of activism in Arizona right now. Arlene Boyle just took out a new annual subscription. She lives in Phoenix. And over in Tucson, Dolores Evans mailed me. And she wants an annual subscription as well. I hope you'll join their ranks. Visit my website, peterbcollins.com. Right under the mugshot of me in the upper left-hand corner, there's a link that says sign up. You click on that. Your choice, $5 a month or more, if you can be generous. Or the best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers get a bonus book of the moment and a bag of Kona coffee while it lasts. The other way you can help us is by, and even if you're already a subscriber, this is a way you can support my show and get somebody else to kick in some money on your behalf. Audible.com features over 150,000 audiobooks for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or other MP3 player. And if you sign up today for a free 30-day trial, your first audiobook is free. You can download any book that you want. And Audible.com will pay me $15 if you sign up for that trial membership. You can cancel within 30 days, and it will not cost you a dime. So this is a no-risk, no-cost way that you can generate $15 to support this podcast and get a free audiobook in the process. There's a link in the show file of this podcast at peterbcollins.com and a colorful banner ad on the left-hand column of the homepage. You can follow either link for the free trial at audible.com. Yesterday, it was 8 internet companies that signed a joint letter to President Obama demanding reforms and reining in of the NSA's spying programs. Today, 500 of the world's leading authors have signed on to a letter which warns that spy agencies are undermining democracy and must be curbed by a new international charter. A digital bill of rights is what they're calling for. And the story I have is from The Guardian in Britain, so they focus on British writers, including Martin Amis, Irvine Welsh, Hari Kunzru, Jeanette Winterson, and a lot of people know about the well-known Indian author, Arundhati Roy. There are many others, a total of 500, who have signed on to this letter, and I certainly welcome their support. We need real reform. We need international standards, and it's not happening in Washington right now. There's some baby steps that are being proposed, but there's real activity at the state level. And get this, in Arizona, where we have this hotbed of new listeners, there is a Republican state legislator. Her name is Senator Kelly Ward. She introduced legislation on Monday that would ban the NSA from operating anywhere in the state of Arizona. I am thrilled to see this. And this Republican says, I believe the number one priority for national security is defending and protecting the Constitution. Without that, the rest becomes irrelevant. There's no question that the NSA program, as it's now being run, violates the Fourth Amendment. This is a way to stop it. Meanwhile, in neighboring Utah, there is proposed legislation that so far doesn't have a named sponsor, but we're told there is someone courageous enough to step up and introduce this in the Utah legislature. And it is an attempt to override a contract signed by the city of Bluffdale to provide water to cool all those servers at this huge data center, the $1.5 billion, I think that price tag is a little low, that scoops up all of the phone record information they collect, the cell phone location information, the 5 billion records a day that they collect, the recordings of our phone calls that they intercept. Yeah, Bluffdale, that's where they're keeping them. And without water to cool the servers, that's a server farm. It's going to die. Now, I have no illusions here. I can't count votes in the Utah legislature. But I would love to see a move to rein in the NSA. And these local efforts are similar to the efforts that Dan Johnson is proposing over at Panda to rein in the domestic detention rules of the 2012 NDAA by intermediation, where local and state legislatures block the actions of the federal government when they're unconstitutional. And in this case, they clearly are. Today, for subscribers, we're releasing a powerful interview with Dr. Carl Hart. He is a neuroscientist at Columbia University. And he's a fascinating man. I first saw him on Bill Maher's show about 2 months ago. Maybe you saw him too, a dreadlocked African-American, 3 gold teeth, very articulate. And there are two parts to his book, but they're interwoven in a very clever manner. One is his personal story. He grew up in a bad neighborhood in Miami, broken home, raised by grandma and aunts, ran with some bad guys, smoked weed, slang some weed. Then he decided that he wanted to play basketball. That kind of disciplined him. Then he joined the Air Force. They sent him to England, where he started his higher education. And now he teaches at Columbia University. And he is one of the most brilliant critics of the war on some drugs who I've talked to over my career, more than almost 40 years now. And in this excerpt, Dr. Carl Hart takes on the myth, number one, that crack cocaine was much more addictive than powder cocaine, And he applies that to the current hysteria over methamphetamine. Take a listen to this excerpt from my in-depth interview with Dr. Carl Hart.
I think that one of the things that I'm trying to make sure we do is not repeat the same mistakes by having people call for tough sentences for drug-related violations. That I'm trying to show people the error in our logic in the ways that we've gone about this. And I'm trying to show people that this is how we were bamboozled previously. Let's avoid being bamboozled in that this way again. And so I think one of the chapters of my book is called The New Crack, and I'm talking about methamphetamine to show people that the hysteria that's being said about methamphetamine is identical to what was being said about crack cocaine. And you see where that led us, and you see how wrong we were. We now notice in science. And I'm trying to show the public how science participated in the misleading of the public. So I hope that I was at least partially successful.
Well, you really opened my mind, Professor, because I've been captive to the same media reporting about methamphetamine. And anecdotally, you know, I have relatives or friends of family members who I've seen get caught up in it. And, you know, they got these weird nodules and rashes that they feature on their hands, sometimes on their faces. So it is kind of scary, but you have undemonized it. Please explain to our listeners the similar chemical structure of amphetamine, which is the active ingredient in Adderall, which is a widely prescribed drug for ADHD, and the chemical structure of methamphetamine.
Yeah, so when we think of amphetamine, which is the active ingredient in Adderall, Adderall, of course, is a drug that people take for attention deficit disorder and also just to stay awake and alert to help them study longer. They are almost identical. There's just a methyl group added to the methamphetamine. But when we tested these two drugs together in people under double-blind conditions, they produced identical effects. Other people have also found this sort of thing, other researchers. And so they are basically the same drug. And when you think of that, that we don't talk about people having Adderall mouth or getting crazy on Adderall, why are we saying people are getting crazy on methamphetamine?
I hope you'll listen to the full interview with Dr. Carl Hart. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And I want you to listen all the way through because toward the end, in a very polite way, he pushes back on your humble host. Because I kind of blow it adopting some of the old mentality that heroin is always innately evil, and that there are some drugs that are just too bad. And what Carl Hart says, that it's not drugs that are evil, it is the way they're used, and prohibition doesn't work, and street drugs are dangerous because you don't know, for example, the quality or the potency of heroin that you might be injecting. So it's a real eye-opener, and he opened my eyes as well. I recommend the book highly to you. It's called High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. Well, as you know, I'm a longtime and sharp critic of California's senior Senator Dianne Feinstein, a nominal Democrat. And today, I'm not going to take a swipe at her about her support for police state activities, the surveillance at the NSA, the drone program of the Obama White House. No, today there is a powerful story published by investigative reporter Peter Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E. He's been on our program before. And he has been diligently investigating Dianne Feinstein and her multimillionaire husband, Richard Blum. Among other things, Blum is chair of a company called C.B. Richard Ellis, and his investment firm owns about 7% of that, and equivalent stake is held by Goldman Sachs. And C.B. Richard Ellis has an exclusive contract to sell the so-called surplus property of the United States Postal Service. And as you know, there's a really ugly effort in Washington with these congressionally imposed requirements that the Postal Service fund its employee retirements in advance. No other federal agency is required to do that. It produces a phony deficit at the post office, which allows the arguments to sell off surplus property, to close big post offices and open smaller ones, and essentially a corporate raid on the federal postal system. So I'm going to link to this article, but I want to summarize briefly some of the findings by Peter Byrne. There is a serious conflict of interest for the husband of a very influential senator to win this exclusive contract. And they're busy violating that contract. For example, it says that they can only sell properties at fair market value or higher. But Byrne reveals that when they sold 52 properties, they showed a loss of something in the range of $79 million below the assessed or fair market values of these properties. In some cases, C.B. Richard Ellis served as the agent on both sides of the transaction and picked up the full 6% commission. And it is selling properties to developers at prices that seem to suggest that there is cronyism going on. And so I hope you'll read this story. It's a chapter from a new ebook that Peter Byrne has published, and I will reach out to him and line up an interview where we can go into this in more detail. But even the people who run the Postal Service are squirming at this exclusive deal that was given to C.B. Richard Ellis, most likely because of the power connection between Dianne Feinstein and her husband, Dick Blum. Great news from Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping. The New York District Attorney has dropped charges of riot and menacing against Reverend Bill Talon and his musical director, Nehemiah. Now, they still face charges of trespass. They were in a J.P. Morgan Chase private bank lobby when members of the choir donned their golden toad masks or headgear and performed songs. Well, the district attorney took a look at the charges and said, well, this was more of like a musical performance. And so it appears that the trespass charges remain, and the next hearing for Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping is on February 27th of next year. Earthalluia, hallelujah, Billy. Glad to see it. General Motors stunned Motown and the rest of the country today by naming Mary T. Barra to become the next CEO of GM. She's only 51 years old. She's worked for the company for more than 30 years. Started out as an electrical engineer, and then she ran the human resources department. I don't know too much more about her and what her approach to running GM will be, but this is refreshing. And it was announced yesterday that the government has sold all of the stock in General Motors that it took as part of the bankruptcy and bailout move at the end of 2008. And the taxpayers recovered all but $10.5 billion of more than $50 billion that was shoveled into General Motors at that time. Now, if you recall, I did not support the bailout of General Motors with taxpayer dollars. I did not fear the bankruptcy that ultimately happened anyway. And as I've told you, the $50 billion was used to shut down plants, lay off union workers, shut down dealerships that wanted to continue to service GM products and GM buyers. And I think that the infusion of federal money was completely unnecessary. And one of the things that I mentioned at the time is we never saw the full international balance sheets of General Motors to make sure that before they took our taxpayer dollars, that they had used up all the capital they had in Mexico and Europe and just about every part of the world. And let me up the ante here. If the net cost of the bailout of General Motors was $10.5 billion, why don't we do the same for Detroit? They're going through bankruptcy. There's going to be a lot of pain, a lot of restructuring. And as I've warned, I think that pension holders who average $18,000 a year in pension payments from the city of Detroit are going to get totally screwed here. And I'd like to see a way for the federal government to bail out at least those pensioners after the bankruptcy court does its damage. Maybe I'm just daydreaming. Well, with some fanfare, the Obama administration is announcing that the so-called Volcker Rule, which was a centerpiece of the Dodd-Frank financial overhaul law and a symbol of the Obama administration's efforts to rein in risk-taking on Wall Street, the Volcker Rule has received approval from all five regulatory agencies, the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, Securities and Exchange Commission, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and the Comptroller of the Currency. And there are some good things here. It's better than nothing. They adopt a harder line than Wall Street had hoped. The rule bars banks from trading for their own gain, limits their ability to invest in hedge funds. It includes new wording aimed at the sort of risk-taking that caused the London Whale to burn through $6 billion in losses at J.P. Morgan Chase this past year. The rule requires banks to shape compensation packages so they don't reward prohibited proprietary trading. All this sounds good, but it doesn't go into effect until 2015, which gives the lawyers and the lobbyists plenty of time to look for loopholes and ways to water it down. And I look to my buddy, we're not friends, but I've had a long-time interview relationship with William K. Black, Bill Black. He presided over the sell-off of savings and loans after that financial implosion in the 1980s. He teaches finance or economics at a university in Kansas. And he is quoted as saying that this is no Glass-Steagall. Do not be fooled. The Glass-Steagall Law, which Bill Clinton repealed in 1999, was the one that set the clear firewall between the deposits of a bank and its own money that it could put into risky investments. And so you're going to hear a lot of blather about how great the Volcker Rule is and how we've achieved this breakthrough in re-regulating Wall Street. But it doesn't, frankly, mean a whole lot. Couple of quickies before I go. I want to welcome home Merrill Newman, the 85-year-old Californian who was detained in North Korea for 6 weeks. He had to write a confession and deliver an apology. When he did, he said that he used mangled English to try to convey to the Western world that these were not his own words. And he had served in the army during the Korean conflict. And apparently he was a little too obvious or too unguarded in asking some of his tour guides if he could meet with former soldiers who he fought with or against during the Korean War. And that drew too much attention and led to his 6 weeks on ice in North Korea. In Thailand, the protesters appear to be winning. Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra has said that she will resign after national elections in February. She dissolved the government, and she is clearly attempting to respond to the demands of the people. We'll see how that one plays out. And finally today, I read with bemusement that Dmitry Kiselyov has been appointed by Vladimir Putin, a great proponent of transparency and public information, to run Russia Today. And so this is the equivalent of putting Bill O'Reilly in charge of a major news organization in the United States, and I'm not thinking Fox. But this guy has been a TV anchor who toes the Kremlin line, attacks homosexuals, says that they should be burned and buried rather than allow their organs to be donated. And so he is a clear lackey, a colorful one, of the Putin government. And I don't watch the American cable channel RT, Russia Today, very often. My friend Tom Hartman is there. I see clips on the internet from programs there, and many of them are very well done. But I have no idea how much Moscow gets involved in the editorial decisions at the American RT channel. And I don't know whether Dmitry Kiselyov will be sending memos to Tom Hartman anytime soon, but we'll be looking for that, all right? Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you are authorized to share with absolutely anyone or absolutely everyone. Thanks so much.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.